Welcome to Between the Before and After, a podcast about the stories that shape us. I'm your host, Coach John McLernan, and each episode I bring you an inspiring guest with a moving story that shines a light on the power of the human spirit. Before we dive in, I want to let you know about two very important things. Number one, the stories shared here are often gritty, raw, and vulnerable, and very likely will include speaking about sensitive topics suited for a mature audience. Number two, this podcast is also broadcast live on YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So on whatever platform you follow myself or Freedom Nutrition Coaching, you have the opportunity to participate in this discussion during the live stream. And we encourage your participation both by commenting and asking questions. And so this podcast is about exploring the stories that take place between the before and after photos, not just in the realm of weight loss, but in all areas of life. So let's dive in. All right. Welcome back to the show. I'm very excited to have with me yet another special guest, because all of my guests are special with amazing, inspiring, and touching stories. And there's actually more than one story involved in Terry's story, because she is also an author as well. So welcome to the show, Terry.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah. So I'd like to give people a chance just to know where you're at currently and what it is that you're doing. And then we'll rewind the clock and take a look at your story and how you got here.
All right. Well, so right now I'm a debut author. I just published my first novel, Sunflowers Beneath the Snow, which is a story about three Ukrainian women, three generations of Ukrainian women starting in the early 70s, kind of going through almost to present time. What's crazy is I released the book in January, about 3 weeks before the current Ukrainian crisis. So I've had quite a few people ask me, like, how did you know? And it was like, oh, if I only had that kind of ability.
Right. Yes. Do you, and I'm curious what inspired Ukraine. Do you have Ukrainian heritage yourself? Is that what?
No. What's interesting is we have a family friend who, a young girl who knew my girls growing up. Okay. She came to the United States in 2013, came back in 2014, and was unable to go back home because of the Ukrainian crisis then, when Russia invaded the Crimean Peninsula. So she came in 2016, told me this incredible little snippet of a story of her life that was so compelling that I wrote 82,000 words of fiction so I could tell it.
Wow, that is quite remarkable. So, and very touching as well. So, life wasn't always necessarily this. Well, being able to kind of, in one sense, live the dream of publishing this story. If we go back, one of the elements of your story that we're going to touch on today is that you spent 14 years in an abusive or emotionally abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious about the backstory just prior to that. In a snippet, because it's always interesting to sort of piece together some of the clues as to maybe how we found ourselves in a situation like that. So, for you, kind of growing up, where did you grow up, and was childhood relatively normal for you?
Yeah, so I, my dad was in the Air Force when I was, born in Athens, Greece. Yep. But then I did most of my growing up years in Ohio. We moved to North Carolina when I was mid-teens. Mm-hmm. I would say, yeah, my parents were happily married and I lived a normal life with, a brother and a cat. And I mean, there wasn't any real craziness. I went to college. I got married. I had four children. The man that I married was, he was very nice, but we were not well suited for one another. And to this day, we remain pretty good friends and have been able to co-parent our children. And that was fine. But when I got out of that relationship, I started dating a man who seemed like a real go-getter and seemed more my speed intellectually and was challenging. And it turned out that what he really was a chameleon. And when I got married to him, he turned out to be something very different. And I think at first I just kind of figured maybe it was the, how difficult is it to marry someone who has four children? My kids were, I guess, 5, 8, 11, and 14. And the 14-year-old was a boy. And I thought, maybe this is just what we're noticing is, difficulty transitioning into this role as stepfather. And so I gave him a lot of leeway and a lot of grace. And then somehow I woke up one day and realized I'm not in a good relationship. Like, this isn't good. but I didn't know how to get out, and I didn't really want to. I wanted to fix it,
right?
Because I didn't want to be divorced twice.
Right, right.
Like that's, you know, that's like a big red letter on your forehead, you know. And I just, yeah, I didn't want that. I just, I just wanted to fix it. So
yeah. So your first husband and yourself, how long were you together?
14 years.
14 years. Okay.
Yeah, I have a 14 year average going. I don't.
Okay. So 14 years together, and just at some point you recognized that you were incompatible or just.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting. I'm a type A, probably A plus plus, maybe another plus personality. And he's very much a laid back, easygoing. When you get to it, you get to it. And there was never a happy medium. You know, both of us were always unhappy because I always felt like nothing was getting done. And he always felt like he was being ramrodded from the back, you know, and it was just difficult to find a happy place in the middle where we both could live life comfortably. And so I think, for us, it really was probably a good thing for us to part ways. And we were able to do so in a way where we lived within 20 miles of one another, went to all of the kids' events together. I mean, we always just continued doing life with the kids the way that we had as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And so that relationship is one that I would say, although it was a failed marriage, wasn't really a failed relationship per se. Right, it just didn't work the way we had anticipated it working.
Yeah. So I guess I'm kind of curious, in the beginning, what was it that drew you to him?
I think the same things that probably pulled me away from him. You know, it's interesting when you're young, you're stupid. You don't know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And maybe ignorant is a good way of putting it.
Yeah. I was in college. I was taking a full load. I was working 3 part-time jobs.
Wow.
And he was so easygoing and relaxed. And when we were together, it felt fantastic because I was always go, 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 go. And so when we were together, it was like just peaceful and relaxed. I don't think I recognized that was his way of life. And that when we got married, he was always going to be that way. There wasn't going to be a speed that was higher than that. And so when we got married, I needed him to step up a little and he needed me to back off. And we just couldn't find that space.
Yeah.
I do not blame him. And I don't really blame me. I just think that neither one of us understood what we were getting in the other person.
Yeah. So maybe it just felt a little bit like a bit of a tug of war in a sense. And so, and I think it's really wonderful that there isn't resentment there and that you were able to make it work. And how was it for, I guess, for your children in that kind of arrangement? You know, how did they navigate that?
You know, when you talk to them, of course, what kid wouldn't want their parents to stay together? I mean, you know, that would be the ideal, right? But as adults, you know, and they're now all adults, 2 of them are married with children, 1's married without children yet. They look back and they say, it's very obvious to us why you and dad couldn't make it together.
Right.
So they see it now. Like it was very apparent. And they have said to us, which is really a good thing to hear, thank you so much for conducting yourselves the way you did. Because they knew that they could have a birthday party and mom and dad could both be there and there wasn't going to be some horrible drama, you know, and people didn't have to sit across the room from one another and glare. I mean, we could sit right next to each other and chat and it was fine. We were fine.
Yeah.
So
that's good. That's good. And so how long had you parted ways before you met this next individual?
I met him pretty soon thereafter. I think, you know, I try to go back and try to figure out how did this happen? Because, I'm a college educated individual. If you had asked me prior to me being in this relationship, if I would ever find myself in an abusive situation, I would have said, no way. There's no way. I'm too smart for that. I'd recognize it. I'd get out immediately. There's no way. And yet there I was not only there was I, but there was I for 14 years trying desperately to make something work that it wasn't possible to make work. I don't know. I think part of me was, I have four kids. How many mm-hmm. men are going to be interested?
Right. Fair enough. You know? So there was like maybe a desire for companionship.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I am definitely, I don't do well alone. It's mm-hmm. not, I enjoy company. I like to talk. I like to go do things and then discuss them afterward. I like to read a book and discuss it. I like to just talk because it's something to do. I mean, I really enjoy companionship. And so, yeah,
you're
you know,
an extrovert.
Yeah, I really am. And so the kids, you know, the kids would be gone on the weekend and visiting with their dad, which I thought was fabulous. But then I'm sitting at home and it was lonely and I didn't like it. You know, so when I met someone who was kind of taking up some of that time and mm-hmm. and liked to talk and liked to read and was suggesting books and then we would discuss them. I mean, it felt really great.
Right. Yeah. Someone who was charismatic, who was kind of being able to maybe match your energy and yep. whatnot. And
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah. And it's interesting because I mean, I was in a business relationship for about 3 years that was emotionally manipulative that ended up costing me my life savings. And so while it's a totally different sort of scenario in one sense, you know, it was somebody who I thought was like one of my closest friends and most trusted friends. And that, you know, cause you know, it's natural to look back and reflect and think like,
what happened?
Yeah. How did I not see that? Because once you see it, you go, oh, there was really some obvious signs. But I think mm-hmm. we don't go into relationships looking for signs that this person might be maybe like a narcissist, for example.
Right.
And I try not to use that term lightly because I do feel like it gets thrown around way too much, way too lightly. But like there are people who fit the clinical parameters, I guess
yeah.
you'd say.
Yeah.
Of actually someone who is a narcissist, so someone who is basically a pathological liar, you know, and very controlling and using emotions to manipulate. And so what do you think he would fit into that category?
I think that if he doesn't, he's close. I think that he may have borderline personality disorder, quite frankly. I'm not a psychologist, so, you know, this is just backseat psychology.
Conjecture, yeah, yeah. Yeah, backseat psychology, yeah, yeah. But I mean, we're all in one sense, I guess, students of human behaviors to some degree, and we try to kind of make sense of it. And of course, in the age of the internet, we can look at, okay, well, there were these patterns or these patterns right. here. So interesting observation, because I mean, you know, you said to him, that you discovered that he was a bit of a chameleon. You know, there was more than one person there almost. And so, you know, you get married and obviously getting married, was there any sort of gut feeling or intuition going in, like getting married, thinking like, I'm not sure if I'm making the right decision or at that
point? I still felt really good. You know, it's interesting. You know, my kids were not super happy that I was getting right. remarried, but they were kids. And, yeah, you know, course, I think they still had this idea that maybe mom and dad would eventually get back together because we were mm-hmm. able to co-parent well together. And, you know,
you could coexist outside of marriage.
Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. So I think they were thinking, well, maybe this will work out. And, you know, so I get married and that kind of throws a wrench in things. But no, going into it, I was thinking that I was getting someone who was going to be really helpful. Mm. As we were dating, so my son was 14 when we got married. So that summer before, I had taken a vacation just with the children and we were at the beach and my son wanted to go out on these long walks on the beach alone. And I want to just like hold him tight and he can't leave my sight. Right. And I was on the phone with, you know, my then fiance who says to me, you know what, Terry, you've got to let go of the reins a little. He's a 14-year-old boy. If you don't give him some space, he's going to take his space. He seemed helpful. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I was still calling my 5-year-old a baby. He was very adamant that, you know, we needed to start not referring to her as the baby. Go help mm-hmm, the baby mm-hmm. get on her shoes. She's 5. We shouldn't be doing that. You know, so he gave me, I thought, like really good advice, helping me to kind of navigate this whole idea that kids get older and you have to start allowing that and figuring out how to, you know, transition through that. I don't know. I really thought that I was getting someone who was helpful.
Yeah. And did he come with like a circle of friends and maybe like what profession was he in?
So I'm going to call him a professional fixer. I don't know what to call him. He would go into businesses that were falling apart mm-hmm. and he would figure out a way to turn them around. Mm. Well, I've decided that what he really was a nasty SOB who could go in and do what needed to be done, which was fire people and be mean and insist and shove. And then he would get it turned around and then they'd get rid of him because right. nobody wanted him around. So he looked successful. Mm. But once you're on the inside and you're watching what he does, you recognize that really what he was doing in business is what he was doing in our relationship as well.
Right, right.
You know, it's that almost same being like, kind of behavior, you know?
Yeah, being a fixer, like you're a project or something.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Yeah, which is really interesting because, you know, generally within sort of gender stereotypes, we see women as trying to fix men. So when did the first like warning sign crop up that, hey, you know, something doesn't feel right here?
Probably within 2 months of getting married.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. Like I started noticing really strange, over the top reactions to things in particular that my kids were doing. You know, if someone didn't do exactly what he said, exactly when he said it, instead of recognizing that you're talking to an 8-year-old and you might have to say it twice or even right. three times, or you might have to try saying it a different way, or you might have to let them know that if they don't go ahead and do what you suggested, that there will be consequences, he would go way over the top. For instance, my daughter left her bicycle in the front yard. He told her, you know, that it needs to be put away in the garage and not left on the sidewalk, which that is true. That's a good thing. Mm-hmm. She left it on the sidewalk the second day because she's 8, mm-hmm. right? And he took her bicycle and she was never having one again.
Right. So very,
I thought
very...
that was kind of over the top for the situation.
Right. Because so
I would have done something more like go out right now and put your bike away. And if mm-hmm, I mm-hmm. find it in the front yard again tomorrow, then you won't be able to have your bike for 2 days.
Right. Yeah. Something a little more reasonable. It's funny. I was actually picturing in my head that he was going to hacksaw her bike frame in half or something.
No,
like that.
No. One time he did throw the vacuum cleaner down the stairs.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it was left at the top of the stairs when someone had vacuumed the hall and they didn't put it away. So his way of handling that was to throw it down the stairs. One time, now this is so stupid, the dumbest things. The kids were fighting over the pineapple juice that I had drained out of the can for a recipe.
Right, okay? Right, right.
So when you have 4 kids and you have this little teeny bit of pineapple juice, they all wanted it.
Right. Right?
And so they're all clamoring, you know, and the way I handle it is, you know, if you're going to fight over it, it's mine.
Right.
It's pretty simple. I mean, you know, yeah. you can either share it or it's mine.
Yeah.
And the next day when I went to get some pineapple out for something else, I noticed on the top of all the cans in permanent marker, 4 adults only.
Wow.
And so the children were no longer allowed to eat the pineapple.
Right.
Huh. Which I thought was a little large for the fact that they were squabbling uh-huh. over pineapple juice.
Right. Now, were you ever able to have conversations with him about these behaviors?
I tried. We tried. Yeah. We actually went to marital counseling. I tried so hard to suggest that. I even went so far one time as to say, you know, let me do the parenting. If you have a problem with the kids, bring it to me. I'll take care of it.
Right.
Because I thought maybe just letting him not feel like he had to somehow come up with the solution.
Right.
Because I always
right.
felt like his solutions were huge. You know, like if it was on a Richter scale, it should have yeah. been a 1 and he was at the 10 mark, you know, and it was like, right. no, they haven't done anything huge. You know, yeah. when he threw the vacuum cleaner down the stairs, they had vacuumed like they had been asked. They just didn't put it away.
Right, right. Yeah. So, during this time, were there still some happy or good moments?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think that's what keeps people hanging on. In an abusive relationship of any kind, if it was always bad 100% of the time, I think you would figure out, I need to get out of this.
Right, right.
Right. But there were still good things. He was still funny. He still was very intellectually challenging. So yeah, there were those good moments interspersed in between, and they were just enough to make you think, that's what I want.
Mm-hmm,
How can I get that?
Right.
you know?
Right. Yeah. Isn't it so fascinating, you know, to think about this upon reflection, right? We look back in hindsight and so on. And I, you know, I think, and maybe you do this as well, I'm like a really big fan of just looking compassionately on our past self. And because we now are able to look back with hindsight and maybe a level of clarity and understanding we just didn't have in that situation.
Well, you know, I tell my kids that I was doing the best I could given the situation that I was in.
Yeah.
And if I had known then everything I know now, if I had been able to step out and look back, maybe I could have made different choices.
Mm-mm.
Maybe I would have made different choices, but you can't play that game. You know, yeah. The truth is that I stayed and I had my reasons.
Yeah.
And although they're flawed, that's what was in my head. And that's, you know, then it really got to the point. It's interesting. You know, I tried to fix this relationship. And of course, it's not fixable. This relationship mm-hmm. was doomed from the beginning because only one of us wanted to fix it. And so
right.
you can't fix a relationship by yourself,
right.
you know, and then the longer it went on, the less sure I was that I was even worth anything. Like it got to me. You know, yeah, in the beginning, yeah. I wanted to fix it.
Right, right.
We were going to make this work. By the end, I stayed mostly because I had no idea what I would do if I left.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating, you know, isn't it?
Yeah, you get to a point where, I mean, I was having trouble going to the grocery store and deciding which brand of peanut butter to buy. I mean, I just didn't know what to do.
Right. So you'd sort of fallen into the grips of someone who was very emotionally yeah. controlling and manipulative.
Yeah.
And knew enough to, you know, I mean, in the world of narcissism, there's like what we call like love bombing, which is, you know, just doing enough to give you a sense of hope so you don't let go.
Right.
Then reverting back to their real self, which is the controlling, manipulative.
Exactly.
And often done in a way that, like, we think about manipulators, but it's like it's often done in a way that's concealed. Like, it's very deceptive, very carefully concealed. And occasionally there's like the outbursts. Did you have any like major blow-ups like with him, or was it always more subtle?
It was very subtle at first, super, super subtle. About 2 years before I left him, I started seeing my own therapist. And mm-hmm. I started seeing a therapist because I thought I had anger issues, because I felt angry all the time.
Right.
And as it turns out, I was feeling angry because I was controlled and I didn't know what to do because I didn't believe in myself. You know, there was just, it was a horrible thing. But as I started working with her, and she did such a great job, because really she should have said, leave him now. But she knew that if she said that I would quit going to her.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't hear it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so instead what she did was she said, look at all of these areas of life and you're putting all of your energy into a marriage. How long have you been trying to fix this marriage? And, you know, at the time it was 12 years. And she said, has it gotten any better? And I said, not really. And she said, well, you know, I have a lot of clients whose marriages are, but they're very happy with their life because they're happy in all of these other areas. How much time would you say you're spending in all of these other areas?
Right.
And it was like nothing, like almost nothing. So she started encouraging me to build those other areas of my life, my family, my friends, my work, my spirituality, all of these things. Well, as I did that, the outbursts between he and I became much more volatile. He never hit me. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot more screaming. There was a lot more in my face.
I'm losing control. I'm afraid.
Yes.
Because on the other side of a manipulator is someone who's afraid.
Yeah.
And so they coerce and manipulate and control. And when there's a sense of I'm losing control, then they struggle to control their emotions and they try to use bigger emotions.
Bigger emotions, right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because it got ugly. It was ugly.
Because if we get emotionally unsettled, we're easier. It's easier to control us.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, so he must've recognized that, this situation that I'm in, like the end is in sight at some point in time.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny because I didn't see the end was in sight. He recognized it, I guess, before I did. He had, one of the things that he did He did it 4 times in our marriage. The last time is what ended it. But he would take all of our money, mm-hmm. remove it from our joint account, and open an account somewhere else where I had no access. Then I wouldn't have access to the money for a while until whatever it was had blown over, and then he'd add me to the account again. Well, on the 3rd time that he did that, I was pretty much fed up with this idea that the money gets taken. And so we started seeing a marital counselor, and I told the marital counselor, I don't want to do marital counseling until he understands that he can't move the money again. That if the money moves again, I'm done. And it took weeks before he would agree that that was an acceptable, you know, an acceptable thing from me. And it was the only real line in the sand that I had. Mm-hmm. Everything else was, we're going to work on this. We're going to work on this. The only thing I asked was, don't move the money.
Right. And was he, were you working at the same time, or was he the primary breadwinner? What was that?
So we were both working. But I was working from home. I was a writer working for small businesses doing their website content and, you know, things along that line. And so I would say that the money was maybe a little more him than me, but mostly 50-50. I mean, and we had always kept a joint account and we had joint credit cards. And I mean, so there wasn't, but he would then take it, and then he would like cancel all the joint cards and I would be left with nothing. And it, you know, of course it was his way of controlling, you know, this is how can you control someone? Well, if you've got all the money, you know, and I've been willingly putting my money into the joint account. You know, it's not like I had my own account, you know? And so, you know, and I just said, you can't do this anymore. You know, you can say things in anger and regret it later, but you don't move money in a fit of anger. It takes planning.
That's not just
It's not like you just yelled, you know, you're just like your mother, you know what I mean? Saying?
And so did you have I think about your first husband and maybe friends, family, anything like that. Like, did they ever pick up on anything and make suggestions or say, hey, something
seems
amiss? I hid things
pretty well.
I
stopped making friends. I stopped bringing people to the house. He had effectively cut me off from most of my family, except for my kids. And from a lot of friends too. And, you know, he was very manipulative, and, you know, before long you found that he was the person that you had to look to for everything.
Right. And that's exactly what these people, what a manipulator does, right? Is gets you. And this, I mean, this does sound like a combination of narcissism and sociopathy, really. you know, so, finally, you got up the courage to leave.
Finally, he took the money again.
Yeah.
And I said, that's it. I'm done. And I called my son and I said, who at the time was 28, somewhere in there. And I said, so if I needed a place to stay for 6 weeks, could it be your house? And he said, yes. And I said, well, you probably need to talk to your wife. And he said, I talked to her 2 years ago. We've been waiting for this phone call.
Wow.
And less than 24 hours later, I was gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Because at this point, like all of your children, your youngest would have been 19.
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, I guess at that point, because they have a degree of independence and whatnot, maybe it felt safer as well.
I think so. And I think too, that I'd been working for 2 years with my therapist. And I now had friends, and I was gaining support from family that he had tried to pull me away from for all those years. And I felt stronger in my business. And so 2 years before I left him, when he had taken the money the 3rd time, I went and stayed with my son for a couple of days. And my son essentially begged me to leave him. And I couldn't. I was not in a frame of mind where I could. And I said to him, and this is such a sad statement, because you have to remember, I'm a college-educated woman. Okay, I looked at him and I said, I don't know what I would do. I would end up being a Walmart greeter and living in a cardboard box. And I believed that.
Right.
That is the hard, you know, I look back at that and I know I said it. I remember saying it and I think, who was that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who was that?
But it's like, it's where we're at. And the interesting thing is, you know, because same sort of thing, right? I'm university educated, well-traveled, all this kind of stuff. And it's like, how did I get in this situation where my money has all been invested in this business, this, you know, and so on and so forth. But it's because it comes from a different part of the brain. It doesn't come from the logical, reasoning, rational prefrontal cortex, right?
It's amazing how differently I see things now. I used to be a lot more judgmental when I would see someone in an obviously bad situation. And my judgment was, why don't you just leave? Right. Like, just leave. It's so simple. You open the door and you walk out. You know,
That's what you thought.
Logical to me until I was in it.
Yeah.
And there's so much more going on than just that. You know, I can't even explain all that's going on, but it's not as easy as walking out. And so now I understand, you know, when I see people in a relationship like this, I realize eventually someone's going to cross whatever line in the sand they've drawn. Mm-hmm. And when they do, they'll be able to leave, and they can't leave before then. So the only thing that you can do is support them in where they are and provide them some tools that they can use when they finally decide it's time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I guess I'm curious, your first husband in all of this, you know, did he ever witness any of this going on? And
yeah, if he was kind of aware, but I don't think he knew. I mean, what's he supposed to do about it?
Sure. Right? Of course. You know,
and he probably had a little bit of fear, because you figure, I'm living with this guy and the kids are with me except on weekends. And if he says too much to tick him off, you know, maybe he would find a way to change what we've been doing this whole time. You know?
The custodial arrangement, that sort of thing. Yeah.
So you have to kind of, you know, look at it from the, it doesn't look good, but what am I supposed to do for her?
So when you like went and to live with your son and his wife, had all your kids left home by this time?
Yep.
Yeah. So you're now on your own. So it was like, you know, I'm just packing all my stuff up and I'm out of here. How many years ago was that?
That was in 2017, five years ago.
Yeah. What goes through your mind as you're walking out the front door, or maybe it was the back door, just the door of that dwelling for like the last time?
Do you know, it's interesting. I was numb. I don't think I felt anything for several days. Yeah. I did what I knew I had to do. My son even looked at me. He came right away. He drove 3 hours to come be with me and help me get my stuff together. And he said, you know, you can't go back.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I know. I won't go back.
Maybe,
but I don't think I felt anything.
Yeah, maybe suppressing all of those emotions that might come up so you didn't make an impulsive, irrational
decision. It was like, I knew what I was doing was the right thing. I knew I needed to leave.
Yeah.
I knew that. There was only one thing I asked him not to do, and he did it, which meant that he would have complete and total control forever.
Yeah.
If I gave in. That's what he expected. I'm sure that's what he expected. He expected me to not be able to follow through, and then he'd win.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I look now today, and I really, you know, it's almost like I should say thank you so much for taking the money that last time. Because if he hadn't taken it, I might still be there. I might still be trying desperately to fix something that wasn't fixable. And instead, he couldn't allow me any happiness or growth or anything. So he had to take that money to prove who was boss. And it gave me my out.
Yeah. So since then, have you had any contact with him? Or no. I mean, did you have to have any sort of court related contact or anything?
Yes.
Like that?
I mean, we had that. There was a horrible incident that happened that I can't prove was him, but I know was him, where a dead cat was left on my porch of my new place 3 hours away. And I know it was him. Like, it sounds like a Jerry Springer show, and I don't live a Jerry Springer life. You know,
that was still an attempt to evoke powerful emotions, fear, that sort of thing. Still an attempt to bring back any semblance of control, because maybe he hadn't found somebody else yet to be able to control in that way.
Yeah. And it was about a month before the divorce was final. I think it was kind of his last hurrah at proving who had the power. And it did scare me. He did a really good job of that. I moved. I moved immediately. I left where I was and essentially went into hiding because it terrified me. I thought anybody who's willing to do that, and it appears that he had cased out my place for a couple of days and like probably was there watching when I found the cat, like everything that I'm pretty sure happened. And it terrified me to think that he'd been watching me. Like that just still creeps me out.
A thinly veiled threat. Yeah. 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 Did you have to get a restraining order or anything like that?
No. So to get a restraining order, you have to tell them where you are.
Okay.
Restraining orders suck, just so you know, because the only way you can have a restraining order is they have to know where you are so that they know where to stay away from.
Right. Right. So to this date, is he aware of where you are or does that location remain?
He might know where I am at this point. I don't worry as much anymore.
Right.
I think that it's been long enough. He just doesn't scare me anymore. Mm-hmm. I've seen him. He looks pitiful now. He does. He looks kind of old and pitiful and sad. And I actually have a little bit of compassion for how badly things turned out for him. Not the kind of compassion like I want to go back and fix it for him, mm-mm, but the human compassion where you could see someone and think, that's a shame.
That's a scared little person who did everything they could, you know, and never could get past that.
Yeah.
And so your current husband who you met, what year did you meet him?
So I met him a year later, had no intention of ever marrying again. Right. Yeah. I've already had two failed marriages. No way. No, I'm not getting married again. In fact, I'm never having another relationship and I'm just going to be a sad, lonely woman and I'm going to live my life through my grandchildren. I mean, that was kind of what I had decided. And so I had started doing a lot of things alone. I love going to theater, live theater. And so I was going to live theater and hating it because I had no one to discuss it with when I was on my way home. But I was doing it because by gosh, I'm going to make this work. And I met my husband, Bruce, and I told him right away, you're obviously looking for something permanent and I am not. Yeah. And so move along. That didn't work. And so then I told him, you know, I'm like full on crazy. I have all kinds of demons in my head. You should move along. And that didn't work. And then I told him, I said, you know, I don't have what it takes to get hurt again. And you're going to end up leaving. And if you leave right now, you're a half gallon of chocolate ice cream and a good cry. So just go now.
Right.
Before it turns into something that, you know, and that didn't work either. And then lo and behold, we're now married.
Yeah.
And happily. I think I figured it out. I think I got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And in 2020, you cycled across the United States with him.
Yes. On a tandem bicycle. Yeah. Wow. And so people call a tandem bicycle a divorce machine.
Yeah.
Because
so if you can survive that,
that's what they said. If you can survive on a tandem bicycle, then your marriage is solid. Because in order to ride on a tandem, you really, really have to work together. And he was the captain, which meant that I had to put complete and total trust in him. He steers and he brakes, right? Yeah. I'm on a bike that he's in control of. Yeah. Most people don't like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And my kids were flabbergasted. They could not believe that I could do that. And I said, you know, it's funny. I did trust him. He's an excellent cyclist. He's been cycling for years. I hadn't been on a bicycle in 40 years. I certainly didn't want to be the one in the front.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. Right. So we rode all the way across the United States, 3,102 miles, raised money for Toys for Tots, which was really exciting. We did that more as an afterthought. Bruce has wanted to ride across the United States since 1976. A group of college kids went, and it was written up in probably Sports Illustrated or something. And he loved the idea and really wanted to do it. And, you know, I had been in this horrible relationship and just really wanted some kind of big adventure.
Right.
You know, something big and bold, the kind of thing that my kids would say, there's no way you can do that.
Right. Yeah.
And they all did. It was perfect. They did just what I needed.
Now, was this ride documented in some way?
Oh, yeah. So I wrote a blog the entire way across. It's called Double Butted Adventures.
double butted, like as in, you know, two butts,
double butted. Double butted adventures. And I kept a blog post every day that we rode, as well as probably twice a month or so prior to going, with all of the lead up to getting yourself prepared for such a ride. So,
because how long did the ride take?
It was 72 riding days. Okay. We were gone for a little over 3 months because you can't just ride it straight. You have to take,
of course,
breaks.
Take some rest days and whatnot. You know, and I'm glad you got the blog, because I'd love to explore that story too, but I think that's like a whole nother episode just about that journey. So I might have to bring you back for that.
Oh, I would love to. I learned so much about life on that trip. I'm actually writing an inspirational book right now based on what I learned riding across the United States. Amazing. That, it has a lot of stories about cycling, but it is not a cycling story. It's about life and the things that I learned. And at the end of that journey, I was able to put so much of the ugly that was still like bubbling up. I found a place for it and I put it away. And it's not that it never comes up anymore, but it rarely comes up. Right. And I can say my ex's name now without like getting goose flesh. I can, I've even, like I said, been able to say he's a sad, pitiful person. And isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, prior to the ride, I was still very angry and hurt and, you know, was hoping that, you know, eagles would fly down out of the sky and peck his eyes out. You know, I mean, I was still very, I was still
wanting
very,
vengeance.
I was still very mad. And
from so much that had been taken from you in that time.
Yes.
You know?
And I was able to kind of put a lot of that to rest. I found myself again. You know, I believed in myself. At the end of that ride, if you can ride 3,102 miles on a tandem bicycle when you're a desk jockey like I am, you realize that you can do whatever you put your mind to. Which is how I ended up writing my book.
Amazing.
So I had already written it, but I was afraid to show it to anyone. And I came back and I got it to a publisher, and here we are.
What was the name of your book again?
Sunflowers Beneath the Snow.
I was going to say Sunflowers Under the Snow, not quite. Sunflowers Beneath the Snow.
Beneath the Snow,
Which is amazing that you managed to write that. And, you know, just kind of one last detail I wanted to touch on, because we were supposed to record maybe a month or two earlier, and you got some really, really difficult news, and we had to postpone this. And so what was that news that you received?
So on June 13th, we thought that my husband was having a stroke. Because his face kind of went slack. He was having trouble verbalizing. Within 5 minutes, he seemed to be better, but we had already called EMS and they felt that it was prudent to take him onto the hospital, run a few tests. They thought maybe it was just a TIA. And so we were breathing easy, you know, good. This was a transient thing. We'll go see the doc and make sure everything's fine. But one of the tests that they did was an MRI, and what they found was a mass in his brain in the left frontal lobe, right near the what's called the Broca area, which is for speech.
Okay.
And what he had experienced was a seizure, and that seizure was because the mass was pressing where it shouldn't be pressing. So on July the 8th, he had an awake craniotomy, which is so. Yes, so they put him to sleep to do the cutting, and then they woke him up and did all the probing while he talked, so that they could make sure that they didn't take his voice.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, it is very fascinating, and he remembers all of it. He said, you know, he was very awake. It wasn't like he was groggy. He remembers having. It was a 4-hour surgery, and he was awake at least 2.5 of it. And he talked, and they asked questions, and he had to squeeze and move his feet on the right side. They were worried that he would lose his ability.
It's going to be a little bit disconcerting. I mean, I almost feel like I should invite him to be on the podcast. Seriously. Just to discuss this experience. if he would, I mean,
you know, right now it would be difficult because although he still has his speech, he now has what's called dysarthria, which the speech pathologist said means you sound like you're drunk when you talk.
Okay.
So he's a little thick, a little thick-tongued. Right. So it's a little more talk like this. So it's a little hard right now. But he's in speech therapy, and they've said that because he has all of the sounds, mm-hmm. they didn't take those. It's just a matter of retraining.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And building new neural connections.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so
that's so fascinating.
But unfortunately, it prognosis? Came back, you know, they looked at the tumor, figured out what it was, and it is a grade 4 glioblastoma. Okay. And that is not a good diagnosis. Of the diagnoses that you could have, it is probably the worst one that we could have had, because according to statistics, 80% of people die within 18 months of learning they have this. Mm-hmm. So that's not good statistics, you know.
Yeah.
So he'll be starting chemotherapy and radiation probably on Tuesday. Yeah. And he'll have that for 6 weeks. And then he'll start on a chemotherapy treatment 5 days on, 23 days off for 12 rounds. Mm-hmm. With MRIs every 8 weeks. And if they see any kind of regrowth, then they change course and try something far more drastic and probably a little more experimental.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's been a crazy turn of events.
No kidding. You know, and I just think it's quite something to be navigating that. And people maybe who wouldn't understand yet what was happening with him would listen to him and maybe not understand, but it must feel like that he's a little bit trapped in a sense. Like, I'm still here. I'm still all here, but I'm not able to communicate the way that I would like, you know, that I'm, you know, for so many years accustomed to communicating. And really,
he's an extremely intelligent man who loves to talk and debate. And it has hampered that. We were at a restaurant today getting lunch. Mm. And when he went to order, the waitress kind of looked concerned and looked at me, and he just looked at me and did like this, you know, in other words, you do it.
Right.
You know, he just didn't have what it took to try to explain to her, I'm not stupid. You know, I'm all here. I'm 100%. My IQ is what it's always been. I just can't get my words out. If you'll lean a little closer and give me a little time, I can get it all out. But people are a little impatient, and they hear someone who's talking like that and make one of two assumptions: that he is drunk, or that he obviously has some kind of mental deficit.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, and that's really difficult, and for you to navigate that as well. And how old is he?
So he's 71.
Yeah. Okay. So so he was 69 when you.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
He's 12 years older than I am.
Yes.
And I don't know. We fit perfectly though. I mean, it's like everything. I tease him. I said, I could have never met him younger because I can hardly keep up with him now. So
yeah, that's something. And you know, just as we wind down, maybe one last reflective question, because I of course would love to spend more time exploring this, but we're running short on time. But just as you reflect on maybe the reality of the situation, that you have a finite amount of time, and maybe we all understand that we have a finite amount of time with the people that we love, but you now have kind of a potential timeline that you're facing that is shorter than, you know, how do you navigate that?
I'm still figuring that out. You know, pretty much it's one day at a time, and sometimes it's 1 hour at a time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my goal is to try to figure out those things that are the most important and do those and focus on those. And, you know, if I have the option of doing something else or spending time with my husband, I'm going to pick spend time with my husband.
Yeah.
Because the truth is, I don't know how much of that I have left.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have all the hope in the world that he's going to be one of the ones that's, you know, the story that everybody talks about, because there are those, you know, there are those people, and he has the potential to be one of those. But I'm also a realistic person, and I understand that the odds are what the odds are for a reason.
Right. And there's a balancing act that we don't want to have misplaced hope, but there is, you know, he's extremely capable and determined, obviously,
right.
You know,
right.
And so, probably a young 71.
In fact, nobody believes what, and he doesn't take any meds other than the new meds that they've had to give him. I mean, you know, he's just a very healthy individual. And and it's hard because you look and you think, well, why? There's no answers. And it's very disconcerting because I like answers.
Yeah, we don't we all?
You know,
we all,
I like a why. You know, explain to me why so that I, you know, can avoid it next time or something. And there isn't an answer. It's just because.
Yeah.
It sucks.
You know, life is actually, I think, the ultimate arbiter of impartiality. We say that life isn't fair, but I say life is actually fair because it is the ultimate arbiter of impartiality. Good, bad, doesn't matter, you know?
Yep.
And, you know, pardon me, that's like another, just, I guess, another journey of growth to go on. And so, you know, really, I want to say, Terry, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you. You're genuinely a ray of sunshine, even through all that you have endured and what you have sort of ahead of you that you're facing, you know, to still be the ray of sunshine that you are. Like, it's really, truly been a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you.
You know, I hope for all of the best, you know. I just hope that you get to make the best of what time you do have left with your husband, regardless of what it might be. You know, I'm hoping for many years, but, you know,
I know. Well, what I've learned is that everybody has a little time clock. Most of us just aren't aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, every morning you wake up, you really have no idea. No one does. Yeah. We just happen to have someone shouting from the rooftops at the moment, reminding us, you know, and so it kind of has adjusted our life a little bit in terms of what is the most important.
Brings things into focus like none other, you know. And so in the show notes, we're going to include all of the links where people can find you and find your book as well, because I think that's really, really important. I imagine you've written an amazing novel because you're a fabulous communicator.
Thank you.
And so probably because there's a few different links there, it's probably easier just to say check the show notes and you'll find
check the show notes, or, you know, head to my website. It's one of the easiest places. It's Terry M. Brown, and that's Terry with one R .com. Yep. And there you can hook up with me and all of my social media, and you can find the book. You can find the book on Amazon, yada, yada, yada. So,
Well, if you were, you know, man, you've had like such a life. I think if you were to offer just one nugget of wisdom, I know it might be hard to condense it, but one nugget of wisdom for people to take away from a conversation like this one, what might it be?
You know, I think the thing that's most on my mind right now would be, don't wait. Don't wait. If there's something that you want to do, or something you want to get out of or get rid of or move on from or move on to, don't wait, because wasting your time. I look at those 14 years, and yes, I grew and it wasn't a complete waste. And yeah, I understand all of that, but there was a lot of wasted time and effort that could have been spent so much better. You know, and then, you know, I didn't get started writing. I didn't do all these things because I just didn't believe in myself enough. And so I say, don't wait. If there's something, you know, don't create a bucket list, actually do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's better to write one thing down on that list and go do it than it is to have 15 things on that list and never get one of them done. Like, you know, go do.
Don't push it into a future that isn't promised.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you really do not know.
Yeah.
I mean, one night my husband was reading to me in bed, and the next day he had cancer.
Yeah.
You don't know. You just don't know. So.
Well, Terry, you're truly an inspiration. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure getting to know you and your story. And I hope we do get to connect again and see what the next chapters of your story have brought you. So thank you so much for being on today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Between the Before and After. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, or leave a review, because that helps this podcast to reach and inspire more people. I love exploring the stories that take place between the before and after, the powerful experiences that shape who we become. And I love human potential. I love the possibilities that lie within us. So whatever you may be up against, I hope these stories inspire you, because if you're still here, your story's not done yet, so keep moving forward.
Anyone can come from any place of brokenness and destitution and build an amazing life.